Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I think it's Wednesday. I've completely already lost track of my week. It is Wednesday, January the 16th. I hope you're having a blessed day. I hope that no matter what is happening today, you recognize that you are blessed because you live in fellowship with the living God. So I think that there are times that when we consider that every spiritual blessing that God pours out into and through our lives and in the fellowship of other believers is really, some days, like, grace is what you've got to hold on to. And so I just want to acknowledge that today. I want to acknowledge that there are days where it does not feel like, where it's not feel, emphasis on the word feel, like blessings are flowing in ways that we have been led by some to expect blessings would flow. But here I would remind us of the Beatitudes at the opening of the Sermon on the Mount. I would remind us of the Beatitudes that actually appear throughout the Scriptures. You know, it's not just in Matthew chapter 5 that we have a list of Beatitudes. We actually have beatitudinal statements throughout the Scriptures. Proclamations not only of God's blessing, but to whom those blessings are going to be poured out, and some specificity related to the characteristics of the individuals who will be receiving those blessings or the people groups. So there are actually some pretty profound beatitudinal statements in the book of Revelation. Maybe that would be fun for us to do one day, just sort of march around in not only the Beatitudes that we all know at the opening of the fifth chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, but march around in the Beatitudes that appear actually throughout the Scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. So, all right, I'm making a mental note of that. Because some days we read the headlines. I got to tell you, I've been reading headlines, you know, for the last 24 hours in preparation for our conversations today. And there's just been a lot of headlines about which I have just simply prayed in response. Because I can't bear out any influence in these situations. My heart goes out to these people, even as my prayers arise to God, that He would intervene, that He would make Himself known, that He would make His presence manifest in ways that the people directly involved can actually experience, that somehow, in some way, in these circumstances, that God would be revealed. And so let's lift up today people in Great Britain who are living with a tremendous amount of anxiety at the failure yesterday of the vote of their parliament, and today are, you know, facing a conversation about whether or not they have lost confidence in their prime minister. Kenya, there was a terror attack yesterday at a hotel complex that is very popular with people from around the world, and one American was killed in that terrorist attack. You heard news at the top of the hour related to Syria. The news that is only being reported in one place where I have read so far. It's really, really cold right now in Syria. And I read one report that at least 15 children froze to death last night, including 13 babies, because there are so many people in Syria not living in adequate shelter. They have so many internally displaced people that there's not anywhere for many of them to find shelter from the elements. Zimbabwe, ongoing crisis in that country related to the protests. And I know that we're looking at Christian leaders being arrested there because they are speaking out on behalf of the people. In Egypt, we've got some conflicting reports today related to our Coptic Christian brothers and sisters. On the one hand, we've got new Coptic churches opening in the capital. But on the other hand, we have Coptic Christians who are being expelled from their church in, it's probably Mina, spelled Mina. And the church was actually closed. A militant group of some thousand Muslim protesters demanded that the priests and the people inside the church be expelled and the church be closed, and the government conceded to that, which is a problem, right? It's a problem when people marauding in the streets can demand that other people's religious liberty be stripped and their houses of worship closed. So let's just be praying the news today and doing what we can to respond. Okay, there are some days where I read an article and I say to myself, I wonder if it would be inappropriate to just read the whole thing on air. Sometimes I read something and it's just that impactful. And so I want to make you aware of a piece written by Adele Banks. Adele writes for the Religion News Service. So this is posted at Religion News. And if you Google Religion News Service, you can probably find where else this is posted. The article title is Dementia and Religion. And then this question, what if I forget about God? And so Adele Banks is the author of this RNS piece. Much of the research for this she did in Louisville, Kentucky, which is the dateline of the piece. And she had a conversation with a geropsychologist, so geriatric psychologist, Benjamin Mast. And he evaluates dementia clients at his University of Louisville research lab. And Adele reports that many people of faith ask one question. Now, I will admit to you, I've been in ministry a long time, and this has never occurred to me. And so I'm troubled by that. I'm a little bit troubled when I read something that seems so obvious and yet somehow escaped me for so long. And this is what people of faith who are struggling with dementia, this is what they ask. What if I forget about God? Now, if that question doesn't make your heart ache, for people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's and dementia of other varieties, I just, wow. So apparently Dr. Mast has a book entitled Second Forgetting, Remembering the Power of the Gospel During Alzheimer's Disease. So I'm going to check it out. I haven't read it yet, just letting you know. But in it, he describes a man who may not always remember his grown children's names, but quickly joins in when somebody starts reading one of his favorite psalms. And Dr. Mast says that what remains intact in the memory is these like long held convictional pieces of our faith, hymns, creeds, passages of scripture that we committed to memory as children. All of that apparently survives even when we can't remember what day of the week it is. Dr. Albert Moeller of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville is quoted extensively in this piece by Adele Banks. And Dr. Moeller, whose office, by the way, is just like down the road from Mass Lab. So he says, look, I have a personal story about this. His mother is in a memory care facility years after receiving a Alzheimer's diagnosis. And Dr. Moeller says, thankfully, she's very aware of God's love. She just constantly reminds us all of how blessed we are. And she'll make statements of how much God has blessed all of us. And he says, look, I just try to assure my students when they, you know, frankly, are heartbroken at the diagnosis of a family member. He is recounting one particular story. And he says, you know, to the student, your grandmother loved Christ. She confessed Christ. She has lost the knowledge of much of her life. But Christ forgets nothing. Christ holds her just as fast. I think that that's a tremendously comforting reminder. And so there's very little that prepares us for these kinds of diagnoses, prepares us for the situations that we end up in as caregivers in our own homes with those who are diagnosed. And I think that as the population ages, and we have an increasing percentage of the population who struggle with these things, we as Christians, and particularly those of us in local churches, we're going to have to increasingly talk about this and find answers. So let me read a couple more paragraphs from what Adele wrote. And again, this is Religion News Service by Adele Banks, Dementia and Religion, What If I Forget About God? Highly recommend this article. She's got two paragraphs in here that are worth sharing. Chaplains in senior citizen facilities have long dealt with residents with dementia and have noticed how some residents recall their religion more than any other aspect of their life. Quote, their faith is the thing. Even as they move further into dementia, the faith remains. That from Reverend Rebecca Church, who's the Director of Pastoral Services at Wesley Manor, which is a United Methodist-affiliated retirement community in Louisville. She says they will remember how to say the Lord's Prayer when they can't even remember anyone's name. They will remember the words to Amazing Grace when they don't even know what day it is. So friends, God's grace is amazing. His steadfast love is certain on this Lord's Day and every day, for this is the day that the Lord has made, and we will find ways to rejoice in it. All right, I got to take a quick break. When I come back, my conversation partner is going to be Justin Gibney. You know him from the AND campaign. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. My conversation partner joining me again today is Justin Gibney. Justin is an attorney. He's a political strategist. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia. He's also the co-founder and president of the AND campaign, which is a coalition of urban Christians who are determined to address the socio-political arena with the compassion and conviction of the gospel of Jesus Christ. My friend, Justin, welcome back.
Hey, Carmen, how's it going?
It's going pretty well today. I hope it's going well for you.
It is. It's been a good day so far.
So I would love to have a conversation with you today about Martin Luther King Jr. We're approaching MLK weekend and MLK Day. And I'm just, you know, last year we all frankly made such a big fuss over it. It was the 50th anniversary of his horribly tragic murder. And so I'm wondering if you feel like there's as much energy around it this year, how the conversation has changed, and what kind of influence he had in your life. So that's a lot of questions. Let's start with where you think we are a year after sort of the big 50th emphasis.
You know, not in too good of a place, actually. I'd like to say it's, you know, it built momentum and, you know, there's a lot behind it. But it seems as if you look at our political discourse, that not a lot of people are kind of leaning on that legacy. I thought last year was great. There was a lot of events surrounding that 50th anniversary. But today, I don't know. I'm a little worried. I think we do need to think on that legacy a little bit this coming Monday.
So it occurs to me, Justin, that like we are tomorrow's ancestors, right? And so when we talk about legacy, when we talk about what we're doing today to make tomorrow different for somebody else, I feel like that's sort of in the spirit of who Martin Luther King Jr. really was. He was visionary. He had a dream. He was passionate about that. And he seemed set on a course that was generational. So I'm interested to know, because in no small way, he was talking about you. Like, you know, he was talking about you when he was thinking about life being different for a generation beyond his own. He was dreaming about you. And so I'm wondering how you experience sort of his legacy in your own life.
No, that's a great point, Carmen. We have to be able to see past the moment. And that's one of the hard things that's one of the things I think we struggle to do today when we talk about civility and all those things, is if we don't see past the moment, then a lot of things that aren't necessary will seem necessary at that time. I think for me in reading up on King and just, you know, not even just reading up on him, hearing my grandparents who are around his age talk about him and what he meant to what they were going through at the time. It's just inspirational. You know, I'm reading a book on him called Parting the Waters right now, and to see what he went through behind the scenes to do what he did really inspires me as kind of the leader of an organization who's seeking to bring about, you know, a biblical worldview or solution to all of these questions and dilemmas that we're dealing with. So, I mean, it's inspiration. You know, one of the things when it comes to his legacy that I think our discourse and our political landscape in general need to deal with is, are we going to see civility and things like forgiveness as weakness, or are we going to understand that that's actually the best way to go about things and the most effective way to deal with the issues that we're struggling with today? That's the question I think we have to answer. That's where his legacy means the most and could be very useful to us.
Friends, again, my conversation partner is Justin Gibney. You can follow him on Twitter and Instagram at Justin E. Gibney, and also at the AND campaign all over the place. When you think about the things that we're talking about today, like in the culture, not necessarily what you and I are talking about today, but what we as a people are talking about today, and what we as Christians in the culture might be talking about, how would you like to see the conversation change?
You know, internally, as far as Christians go, I would like to see more white evangelicals and Christians of color talking about these things together and talking about them with the application of Christian principles and less in terms of partisanship. As you know, I'm one of the big, I don't have a problem with being in people being in political parties. I'm in one. But when we have these conversations as Christians, we should be able to step out of those boxes and really talk about it in a way that deals with the common ground that we have, which is the Bible and the principles that come from the Bible. So I would like us to have those conversations on different terms, more biblical terms.
Well, can you tell us what some of those are?
Yeah. So for instance, when we talk about poverty, kind of stepping out of what we're expected to say based on our parties and starting to think of it through a biblical lens first. Right. So I don't necessarily have to bring the Democratic agenda with me. Right. I'm bringing a different conversation and we can worry about the rest of that later. Same thing when it comes to religious freedom. You know, if I talk about religious freedom as a Democrat, then I either don't talk about it at all or I pretend like it's only a matter of discrimination. But if I step out of that and talk about it as a Christian, well, now I can understand why it's important, not only for Christians, but for folks of all other religions. But unless we step out of those kind of ideological or partisan boxes, we're not really addressing it as Christians first. And I think that's what needs to happen.
I kind of like the Christians first language. Like, I feel like, Justin, that is not what most people in the culture are. I mean, even Christians are not Christian first in most things. And so I think that begins to change the conversation between us on lots of different levels. If I know that you and I are going to engage in a conversation and we're both going to come to that conversation as Christians first, you know, I've really already established that, look, I'm spending eternity with you, so I might as well try to figure out how I'm going to get along with you now.
Yeah, like, that's right? Absolutely right. Yeah,
that's sort of the most basic. I feel like that's kind of the most basic common ground. If we can get to the place where, regardless of whatever the differences are between us, if we can get to the place where, all right, look, Carmen and Justin are both Christians, so they're each going to approach whatever conversation it is that they're having with this Christian first mentality, attitude, principles, and they love each other enough to call each other out if they see the other one not doing that. Like, you're totally... You have the absolute right, in fact, responsibility to say to me, okay, hey, that's not a Christian first way of talking about this. Like that. You know, we agreed this was going to be a Christian first conversation, and that you're operating out of something else right now.
Right.
I think that if we could get to that place in our conversations with, you know, not just between you and me, but with other people. And if we could get people to agree that is going to be the sort of first rule of engagement, I do think the conversation would begin to change. I just don't see a lot of people, Justin, willing to move into conversations and actually take the time to establish, hey, what's our common ground? What are going to be what are going to be our agreements for in terms of discourse and in terms of the exchange of ideas in this conversation? I just see people just leaping in and torching each other.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as you know, that's in a nutshell, that's the AND campaign's message. Put Christian principles first and worry about the other stuff later. And it doesn't mean that we're going to agree on every subject. But as you mentioned, it does set the terms of engagement in a lot better way than our political landscape is setting them now. And, you know, and it's really a matter of, you know, people being brave enough to do it, to step up and critique your own side and say, hey, here are the issues that we have. How can I address you? The beauty of all of this is that the Bible gives us a framework for all of this. And if we use that biblical framework, we should know how to address each other. We should know where our common ground is. And now all we have to do is really apply it.
Again, friends, Justin Gibney, you can find him at the AND campaign. You can find him on Instagram and Twitter at Justin E. Gibney. All right, my friend, I'm going to let you preach for a minute. So Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream. I want to know what you're dreaming for this nation and what you're dreaming, you know, for your own kids. What's your dream?
Yeah, my dream is, again, it starts with believers. My dream is that believers will step away from the tribalism, will not find their identity in partisanship or any of those things, but will find their identity in Christ, even in the public square. And so my dream is that we're not just Christians when we're in the four walls of the church and then we step out of the church and we become primarily conservatives or progressives. No, we are Christians inside and out. And if there may be a certain ideology that kind of fits in there from time to time, that's fine. But I want Christians to really stand up and say, look, my principles must lead me, and I'm going to hold, you know, myself and others to those standards. And at the end of the day, what that means to me practically is compassion and conviction, that we will be compassionate, that we will lead with compassion, but we will speak up when God's truth is under assault. And in order to do that, we have to step away from the ideology and the partisanship a little bit and really look more closely to what God is asking us to do in the public square. How are we going to restore what's around us?
You know, I love talking with you. I want to catch up face to face sooner rather than later. Tell us what is on tap right now for the AND campaign. If folks want to get engaged, where would you invite them to do that?
So if you're in Chicago, we actually have a big event coming up on Monday, which is Martin Luther King's MLK Day, where we're throwing a mayoral forum, a faith and politics mayoral forum for the Chicago mayor's race, which is probably the biggest political race in 2019, if not, you know, top three. And so we got 70 plus churches together to say, hey, we want to make sure that believers are heard. And so we'll be doing that around the nation. But if you're in Chicago, you can do that. Otherwise, you can go to The Crux and the Call if you want to see our content, thecruxandthecall.com. That's where you can see our content and our messaging, and you can reach out to us, and we'll get you active in your area.
I love it. Hey, Justin, thank you so much. Have a blessed weekend, and I look forward to catching up with you soon.
Thanks, Carmen. Take care.
Thank you. All right, friends, that's Justin Gibney and the AND campaign. You can check them out online at thecruxandthecall.com. You can connect with Justin on Twitter and Instagram at Justin E. Gibney. You are listening to Connecting Faith. After the break, I am going to be joined by our friend Tim Muehlhoff from Biola about his new book, Defending Your Marriage, The Reality of Spiritual Battle. This is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Joining me now, one of my regular conversation partners, and that's Dr. Tim Muehlhoff. He is a professor of communication at Biola University in La Mirada, California, where he teaches classes in family communication, interpersonal communication, persuasion, and gender. And sometimes we talk about any number of things. He's the author of some great books on communication, Beg to Differ, Marriage Forecasting, the co-author of The God Conversation, Authentic Communication, and Winsome Persuasion, one of my favorites. He and his wife, Noreen, are frequent speakers at Family Life Marriage Conferences, and he also serves as a speaker and author at Biola's Center for Marriage and Relationships. He's joining me here today to talk about his new book, Defending Your Marriage, The Reality of Spiritual Battle. Tim, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Oh, thank you, Carmen. I'm so glad to be back.
So I love this, first of all, the recognition that marriage is totally under assault. And I think that sometimes we think of marriage being under assault in the culture, but that's really not what this book is about. So Explain to people how marriage is under assault.
Well, I think if we were to ask the Apostle Paul, he would be shocked today that we don't talk more about spiritual battle when it comes to all aspects of the Christian life, let alone marriage. So it's interesting when he writes to the church at Ephesus, in the original letter, there's no chapter breaks whatsoever. We later added that for convenience sake. So if you read his great explanation of marriage in what is known as chapter 5, it immediately bleeds into chapter 6, which is his talk about spiritual armor and the need for all of us to utilize the Word of God, prayer, righteousness to protect ourselves. So in my mind, when you read Ephesians, it is impossible if you were to remove the chapter breaks. It is obvious as anything that he has linked marriage to spiritual battle.
So I remember speaking at a women's event in, I feel like this was somewhere in South Carolina on the coast. I can see the church, but I can't call it to mind. I'm talking about this women's event, and one of the things sometimes when I'm with women that I'm talking about, I'm just kind of doing a Q&A at this point in the conversation. One of the things I talk about is, you know, frankly, the way we dress. And I tend to encourage women to, you know, although we are to be fishers of men, I say we're not supposed to dress like bait. And it's funny and everybody gets it. And then a woman raised her hand and she said, can you talk more about that in terms of each of us defending one another's marriages? And that was really, I thought that was a really astute observation. Like, what I'm choosing to wear is not just about me and how I feel about myself. It is about what's happening in the hearts and minds of other people who are with whom I'm spending my time. And that person is married to somebody else, right? And so the enemy can use so many things. So I'd love for you to talk about like some of the stuff that the enemy uses that we need to be strengthening our marriages against.
Yeah, let me make a quick comment. I love that what you're saying. So when Paul decides to use a Roman soldier as his model of what the armor of God looks like, immediately we understand what made Rome so effective on the battlefield is that they fought as a fighting unit. A legion was arm-in-arm linked fighting against, you know, the opposition. So in a Roman army, you have to depend on the people on your left and right. I think when Paul picks a Roman soldier to kind of model the armor of God, we have to take that into account as well, that this was a fighting unit that if you broke off for whatever reason, lagged behind, you would affect the whole unit. So I love what you're saying is my marriage isn't just about me. It's about other marriages. And so what I do has a huge impact on other people, everything from word choices to what I choose to wear, whether I choose to quit on my marriage. I tend to think that's just a decision that will affect me or my kids. But if Paul's analogy is true, then it's going to affect the whole Christian community. And Paul says that. I want you to be other-centered. I want you not to just think about yourself, but I want you to think about other people. And I think that's an incredibly important point. I would say when it comes to culture, John makes a fascinating statement. He basically says the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, I think if you look at the Greek, he means the structure of the world, the structure of culture. So he's talking about most likely Rome, the impact of Rome. But today we need to take a look at culture. How has Satan influenced how we think about women, how we think about marriage, how we think about commitment, love, sex, dating? And not that culture is all bad, because God's infusing it with goodness, just as Satan is trying to infuse it with a deviation from God. But we need to be aware that culture deeply impacts all of us. And so I love what you're saying. Even the way we dress, we need to think about who's influencing style choices and how we view the world and view each other and view God.
Friends, again, my conversation partner, Tim Muehlhoff, the book, Defending Your Marriage, The Reality of Spiritual Battle. We actually have some copies available. If you're interested in entering that drawing, you can text me at 877-933-2484. Let me say it again. 877-933-2484, or you can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. So yesterday, Tim, here on Connecting Faith, one of my conversation partners was Dave Pittman, and he's a musician. I mean, he's a, you know, singer dude, and he has a new album out called A Different Kind of Love. And one of the tracks on the album, he actually has more than one on there that he co-wrote with his wife. And they are, these tracks are like about marriage and fighting for your marriage. So there's one called Fight to Win. And when I asked him to tell me, like, what's behind that, he said, you know, so early in our marriage, you know, there's times that you fight. And he said, I just realized as the, you know, seeking to be the spiritual leader of my own home, seeking to cultivate the kind of marriage that I want to, you know, I want to be in for a lifetime. We can't fight. We have to get on the same side of this, and we have to fight for our marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, as a really young guy, that's so astute. Like, I'm so glad people are thinking this way. So give us a practical example of entering into spiritual battle on behalf of our marriage.
Yeah, and I would say to that artist, I commend him for that song, but we could make the mistake of thinking that this fighting for our marriage is just between me and my spouse, right? We're working our stuff out. Maybe add the kids in there too. But what the whole book is about, defending your marriage, is you are fighting on a battlefield, not a spiritual, not a romantic balcony. So Satan is wanting to take that argument, and he's wanting to twist it whichever way possible. Paul's going to use the word foothold, which means, in the Greek, it means opportunity. So Satan is looking how you deal with this argument, and he's looking for any cracks that he can manipulate, like you're being bitter, you're being sarcastic, you're not forgiving, you're not having a Christ-like attitude. So let me give you an example I use actually to open the book. My wife had been telling me for weeks that the faucet was leaking underneath the sink. And again, I'm not a Mr. Fix-It kind of guy, and I was really busy, and we're leaving to speak at a marriage conference. So literally the morning we're leaving for LAX, Noreen goes underneath the sink, and now it's really leaking, and we have no time. I mean, LAX is a nightmare. You just can't be late. So as we're driving, she's frantically trying to call a plumber and mad at me, rightfully so, that I didn't address the sink weeks ago. And now I'm defensive, and so now there's kind of like silence between us as we're going to go speak at a marriage conference, for crying out loud. So here's what I would say. I don't think Satan got underneath the sink with a wrench and loosened the pipes. I don't think he did that, but he sure looked at that opportunity to say, I can drive a wedge between Tim and Noreen and use that sink as the means of doing that. And again, we can't use spiritual battle as a cop-out. I can't look at my wife and say, honey, you know what's really happening here as we drive to LAX is that we're under spiritual attack. It's not really the pipes. Well, Noreen can counter and say, honey, it is the pipes. I asked you to fix it, and you didn't for whatever reason. So we can't use spiritual battle as a get-out-of-jail card, but at the same time, know that as we're working out this issue, Satan is trying to manipulate things so that we get angry at each other, we hunker down, and we're not kind or compassionate to each other.
Okay, Tim, so there's now people who are there are at least some people listening right now who are trying to figure out what we're talking about. Because they're not sure that Satan is real. And so they're fairly certain that this can't really be what's going on. So can we probably should have started here. But let's back up and let's substantiate that from the Bible. You're going to make these arguments from the Bible in this book, Defending Your Marriage. And you are actually going to expose Satan, where he is and for who he is. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Carmen, it's a great question. The reason we believe in Satan primarily is because we believe the Bible is inspired. We believe the Bible is inspired by God. So 25% of everything Jesus talked about had to do with spiritual battle. Every New Testament writer talks about spiritual battle. If you look at the Bible, it begins with spiritual battle in Genesis and ends with spiritual battle in the book of Revelation. So if we believe the Bible is inspired by God, if we believe that it's authoritative, then you have to believe in Satan because spiritual opposition, Satan, is found all the way throughout the entire Bible. So it may be out of fashion. It may even seem a little anti-intellectual to say I believe in a literal Satan. My goodness, just those words coming out of my mouth, right? But that's what the Bible says. So we've got to sit back and say, fundamentally, do we believe what the Bible is saying? And it, without a doubt, subscribes to a literal Satan, literal demons, and that the world is under spiritual attack. So if we believe the Bible, we've got to buy into this idea of spiritual battle.
And so that people don't think it's a book about Satan. It's a book about marriage, and
yes.
It's a book, and I would say it's a book about the tools that we have available to us that we ought to be implementing, that we ought to be using: prayer, meditating on God's word, mobilizing fellow believers, you know, linking arms, armoring up. I mean, I love the images. So encourage people to, maybe I should put it this way, Tim. We're kind of in a give up culture when it comes to marriage. If I don't feel quite as zesty about this person as I did once, or if things get hard, or if they disappoint me, or if life together isn't going the way that I thought that it was going to go, you know, I can just check out and move on. Please help us rehabilitate and redeem what marriage is supposed to be, because that makes it worth defending.
Yes, absolutely. So the chapter that's gotten the most buzz is the chapter on how do you know I'm under a spiritual attack? How can we ever really know this? Or is this just a rank-and-file argument that we're having? Well, one of the things that I explore in the chapter on diagnosing whether this is actually happening in your marriage is, do you give up hope? If God's called you that your marriage is supposed to be a representation of Christ's love for the church, that's Ephesians chapter 5, then if you're to the point in your marriage where you feel like, okay, I'm giving up, my spouse is never going to change, I'm sick of this, I'm sick of the tension, I'm sick of this, so I'm just moving on, that's a sign of spiritual battle, because God is a God of hope, and what he's called you to, he's promised that he will equip you, and not that you won't go through hard periods. So if the listener right now is thinking, man, my marriage is unfixable, and I really want to move on, that's coming from Satan. That's not coming from God. And so if we think it's coming from Satan, if we think this is demonic, then we need to have spiritual battles that resist against that. And I have a whole chapter on what do these prayers sound like, and should we say them out loud? And the answer to that is yes. Demons can't read your mind. So I would say it out loud. Satan, I rebuke you in trying to drive me apart from my husband. I rebuke you that you're trying to get me to have hopelessness, that I no longer believe God can intervene in my marriage. We need to be that specific. And I don't doubt, Carmen, that's going to feel weird at first, right? One time we were saying warfare prayers throughout our house, and we forgot that our youngest son was in his room. So he walks out going, okay, what is going on? Because we're saying these things out loud. So I even have an interview with one of our Bible scholars at Biola on how did the Puritans have family meetings where they would talk about spiritual battle. And so as a family, I think we need to address it. If we're going to be biblical, then we've got to believe that there's spiritual opposition to our family, and how do we address that? Through prayer, Bible study, pulling in people to fight shoulder to shoulder.
Friends, the book is Defending Your Marriage, The Reality of Spiritual Battle. Tim Muehlhoff is the author. We do have some copies available. If you'd like to enter the drawing, you can text me at 877-933-2484, or you can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Tim, it's such a great encouragement. Thank you for equipping us in this area of our lives. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's such an important, often overlooked topic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, friends, this is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It is the point in the show where I like to do something called make the connecting point. So you know by now, this has a lot of variety to it. And so what I'm going to do today is I'm going to share part of an article that I read, and then I'm going to use it as a conversation starter about something that's going to seem unrelated. So I'm just warning you in advance that's what's about to happen. So because the article is not about something that I'm actually going to delve too deeply into, but it provokes a really good set of questions for those of us in the church. So that's where I'm headed. I'm headed toward what's the provocation for conversation here for those of us in the church? And so my jumping off point, the headline that I'm going to attach this to, is Beto O'Rourke's very extended two-hour interview with The Washington Post. And so the headline is not really indicative of really, frankly, the content of the conversation. So I think that's kind of interesting as well. So if you were looking for this, it's called Beto O'Rourke's Immigration Plan, No Walls and No Specifics. But the portion of it that I just want to read to you comes fairly early on. It says, throughout the two-hour interview, O'Rourke boomeranged between a bright-eyed hope that the United States will soon dramatically change its approach to a whole host of issues and a dismal suspicion that the country is now incapable of implementing sweeping change. So what's happening in this, in the course of this two-hour conversation, is that Beto O'Rourke is at some points really filled with hope. He's talking about the possibility of dramatic change on a whole lot of issues. But then he seems like this like dark, foreboding character who has this deep suspicion that the country is at this point capable of implementing the kind of sweeping change that he hopes might happen. And so at one point, the reporter just directly asks, which is it? Like, are you hopeful that you're going to see dramatic change on these issues, or do you actually suspect that things are never going to change? And Beto O'Rourke, I mean, he is a politician. Let's just be mindful of that. He paused. And I think he's probably there weighing whether or not to answer all. And he answers in this way. You know, I'm hesitant to answer because I really feel like it deserves its due. And I don't want to give you, actually just selfishly, I don't want a soundbite of it reported. But yeah, I think that's the question of the moment. Does this still work? Now, does this still work needs further amplification. And so what does he mean? Does this still work? What does working mean? And what does this mean? Well, he's talking there about the whole American experiment. He went on to say, can an empire like ours, with military presence in over 170 countries around the globe, with trading relationships, the security agreements in every continent, can it still be managed by the same principles that were set down 230 plus years ago? The reporter then says, O'Rourke does not yet know the answer, but he's ready to discuss it. Now, for Christians, I view that as a wide open door for conversation. And so when you are looking for places where the media, the culture, even the political discourse of our day hands you on a silver platter an opening to a conversation that's worth having, this is one of them. Does this still work? The same question that he's asking about our country and its founding principles and whether or not we can still function based on those founding principles in a world that's radically different than the one that our that the framers of the Constitution inhabited. You know, the same question is a question that Christians can ask about whether or not the principles of the Bible, you know, still provide the framework that we need to function in the world in which we live. Now, I'm not equating the Constitution with the Bible. I'm equating the conversation. I'm equating the kinds of questions that we as Christians in the church must be asking in order that we can be answering the questions that the culture is asking. Like, that's the goal here, right? To become equipped to engage in the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus. So let's adapt the question for the church. What are the managing principles of the church in America today? I mean, are our managing principles biblical? And if they're not, then what in the world are we doing? Like, that just seems to me like a good starting place for a conversation. I mean, what would a conversation look like in your local church or, you know, in your denomination, wherever it is that you engage in such conversations? What would it look like for you to say, hey, what are our managing principles? So I pressed that point with Justin in our conversation. Like, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, we want to talk together and have the application of Christian principles. It's another thing to be able to articulate those. So I pressed that question forward with us here. What are the managing principles of the church in America today. And if they don't line up with the Bible, and when we talk about managing principles here, what are we talking about? Like, I think that's even a challenge for people to think about. I think a lot of people are not thinking what they're thinking, not thinking about what they're thinking about. Their minds are not set on things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of the Father, as we are commanded in Scripture to do. Most people are not thinking about anything. They're just not thinking. So part of the initial challenge here is to actually get people thinking. What does it mean to have a managing principle or a set of managing principles? Well, you better have a set of managing principles if you're raising kids. And you better have a set of managing principles if you're running a company. And you better have a set of managing principles if you're, you know, out there with the rest of us on the roadways of life. So we do have managing principles. It's just we don't spend a lot of time thinking about them. So do we have a cohesive identity as the body of Christ in America today? I would say no, we don't. Do we have like legitimacy to our denominations? I would say for the most part, no, we don't. How about an orthodox theology that we all share and espouse and live by? No, we don't. How about consistency in terms of moral leadership and therefore the earned right to speak into the conversations of the day with moral authority? No, we don't. And here I'm talking, you know, collectively or comprehensively about the church in the U.S. today. And we don't. We don't have moral leadership that has the kind of integrity that can step into the public and political discourse of the day and tell people who need to be told to stop it. Stop it! Like, who has the moral authority in genuinely the moral authority that comes by being a person of Christ and a person who's obviously been with Christ and a person who speaks with that kind of authority? Remember, Jesus, like, they're like, you know, we're not saying anything to him because he is teaching as one who has authority, not as the scribes, right? Christians ought to be able to speak with authority, the very authority of Christ, into the cultural conversations of the day, but we can't do it because our moral leadership has been compromised by our own behavior. That's a failure. All right, well, what else is going on? When we talk about this question, does it still work? And we talk about whether or not the church could still be managed by the same principles that were set down not 230 plus years ago, but more than 2,000 years ago. You know, I say the answer is yes. Yes, it still works. We just haven't worked it for a long time. And I will say that, yes, the same principles that exist in the scripture and that were laid down over the course of thousands of years, most recently 2,000 years ago, do they still work? To govern us, yes, we just haven't tried them. We have not lived under their authority, and we have not lived into their promises. So maybe we ought to give it a try. So this is my encouragement to us today as believers. Let's take what the culture is giving us. Let's take the kinds of conversations that are being asked in the culture. Let's engage them with the mind of Christ, and let's see if together we can actually live into this next generation, this next season of being together as God's people in the world in this generation in such a way that people might actually turn aside from the other things that they're doing and say, something's going on there that's worth looking at. Maybe they could even turn aside and see a burning bush and in us and with us experience the reality of who God is. All right, friends, that's all we got time for today. I love being with you here on Connecting Faith. You can join me right back here tomorrow. You can catch the podcast at myfaithradio.com on the Connecting Faith page. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.